again to the Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. And in the studio with the 4th of July coming up, I thought it might be fun to talk to the, composer of several of the very popular patriotic marches that we hear around this time of year. So in the studio across the desk from me here right now is John Phillips Souza. Good afternoon, sir.
Good evening. How are you?
I am just doing great, and it's great to have you here. Of course, we know a lot of your music and so on, but I'm not sure the people know your humble beginnings and where you came from and what you went through in your life.
Well, where I came from depends on who you ask.
Okay.
If you ask my publicity man, I was born in Italy, France, Germany, and Britain.
All at the same time.
Well, we toured three times in Europe. The first time we toured in Italy, he let the word out that my name was really Giovanni Filippo Souza, and I was an immigrant from Italy.
I see.
When we went to France, I became Jean-Philippe Souza, an immigrant. In Germany, he changed it up a little. He decided I was Siegfried Ochs. And when I went to the United States, I chalked S-O-U-S-A on my trunk.
Oh, wow.
In Britain, he did the same thing, only he called me Sam Ogden.
Sam Ogden.
Now, that's my press agent story about my origin.
So it changed depending on the venue where you were performing, apparently.
It depended on what he thought would sell tickets.
I see. But actually, you were born, I do believe, in Washington, D.C.
In Washington City, in the District of Columbia, November of 1854.
1854.
I grew up during the Civil War there, in a town full of bands.
Well, you know, a lot of, most towns had their own little bands, churches, granges, and so on. Every little town had all kinds of bands, yeah. Boy Scout bands.
In Washington during the war, every regiment that came through had a band, so we had lots and lots of them. Matter of fact, my father, John Antonio, he played trombone with the United States Marine Band, so I was exposed to music from a very, very young age.
Yes, you were. So did you live most of your young years in Washington, D.C., or did you move at some point?
No, we stayed in Washington. I stayed there during my childhood. When I was 13, I was offered a chance to run off with a circus band. I wasn't smart enough to keep my mouth shut, and my father discovered the plan. He said, "Now, Philip," that's what he always called me, "Philip, tomorrow morning you put on your best clothes, and after breakfast you and I will go see about getting you a job." Well, we didn't go to the circus. We went to the Marine Barracks, and I was enlisted as an apprentice musician.
Oh.
And remained there for the next 8 years. So,
mm-hmm.
It was a good education. I learned almost every wind instrument, some better than others, and certainly not star soloist grade on any of them. Violin is my real home instrument. But
I see.
Anyway, in 8 years, I got a broad education and then broke out and went to Philadelphia and New York, conducted orchestras, was a concert master with others. And then in 1880, Papa sent me a telegram and said, "Philip, there's a job opening with the Marine Band. They want a director." So I came back home and spent the next dozen years. And the Marine Band was pretty good when I got there. By the time I left in 1892, it was the best band in America. And you're hearing it from a guy who knows what a good band sounds like.
Sounds like it. Sounds like it. Did you ever play with a cigar band?
I fiddled with them, but you don't get much music out of them.
I have this weird sense of humor.
I have a partiality for cigars.
Yeah, so I've heard. All this time with... when there are several... well-known marches now that you had penned Would you like to tell us about some of those or the origins, or did you write them for special occasions?
The first big hit I wrote was called Gladiator. It wasn't dedicated to anything in particular. It was a good title. And I knew I had made a hit in public when I found myself walking down the street and heard an organ grinder playing my march on his machine.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I gave him all the change in my pocket because I felt like I had hit the big time. But no, there were marches written for events and some just because they were good pieces. The Washington Post was written for an essay contest for the local newspaper in Washington and later became very popular as a way of introducing people to a dance called the two-step.
Okay.
A little while later, I wrote Semper Fidelis, dedicated to the United States Marine Corps.
Isn't that their theme song now, or whatever you call it?
Well, I'd like to think they play it from time to time.
Okay.
But to my mind, Semper Fidelis is the best march I've ever written musically. But I wrote a number of others. The only thing wrong with writing marches at that period for me was that I didn't know how to price them.
Oh.
The Gladiator, the Washington Post, Semper Fidelis. My publisher bought for $35 a piece, outright.
Oh, my.
And I had to provide a piano, a band, and an orchestra arrangement. I was not a good businessman in my early years, but I got over it.
One of your most famous, I believe, is the Stars and Stripes Forever. That is
that
one of your tunes,
my,
right?
That is far and away my most successful march. Mm-hmm. I have made many thousands of dollars off of it and made many audiences happy.
So tell us a little bit about your personal life. I know that there is a Mrs. Sousa.
There is. I met Mrs. Sousa, well, in the late 1870s. I was touring with a company that performed the Gilbert and Sullivan HMS Pinafore. She was in the chorus. The first thing I noticed about her was that she had a glorious head of auburn hair, and before too very long, she became Mrs. Sousa, and we have John Philip Jr. and Helen and Priscilla Ann, two daughters and a son, so... In a way, it was the coming of the children that led me to leave the Marine Corps because I was making $1,200 a year directing the Marine Band. In 1890 and 91, the Navy Department had some funds and let us tour part of the eastern United States. Well, the Marine Band made a hit wherever it went. We were, as I say, one of the best around. In 1892, I asked if we could do it again, and the Secretary of the Navy said, no, we don't have the money in the budget. But a man named David Blakely, a promoter of various kinds of shows, came to me and said, Sousa, how would you feel about a job that paid $6,000 a year? And I said, please keep talking. So that was five times what I was making with the Marine Corps. And Blakely and his financial backer said, here's what we want. We want you to develop a touring concert band as good as the best band in Europe, and we'll back you. So I didn't have unlimited money to spend, but I could generally hire the best musicians I wanted for any position. That makes all the difference in the world.
Go ahead.
As kind of an aside, I have two requirements for a musician in my band. They've got to be first rate. They've got to be good enough to solo anywhere. And they've got to be somebody who gets along. We go on tour for 6 months at a time and play two towns a day most of the time. So those of us in the band are thrown together on a regular and almost frighteningly sustained basis. If you don't get along with other people, you won't be a good fit in my organization.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, I was offered a chance to organize a commercial band, did, and since 1892, other than a couple of years during the Great War, the band and I have toured the United States, Canada, Europe 3 times, and once completely around the world.
Oh, my.
So we've gotten around a bit.
Sounds like it. Back to your children, did any of them seem to have any musical ability or any direction?
Ability, yes. Interest, no.
Okay.
So they're perfectly content to have Papa make the music.
And did Mrs. Souza get to go with you on your tours, or did...
Sometimes.
Sometimes, okay.
When we went around the world, Mrs. Souza and both of my daughters went along for the whole trip. We were gone almost a year. But my son, John Jr., went to college and graduated in 02 or 03, and he's in business. He's a smart young fellow, but not interested in doing music for a living.
Well, that's all right. That's perfectly understandable. I'm looking at your schedule of your appearances.
Yes,
just in the state of Ohio.
I have a booklet like that made up by the office for every state we go to. So if somebody says, have you ever played in Akron or Zanesville or Ada, I can pull it out of my pocket and say yes and tell them when.
Looks like between January of 1898 and October of 1920, if I have my...
Mm-hmm. Yes, we played Marion several times.
Yes, 5 times in that...
Once at the Chautauqua Pavilion out east of town in the park, and 4 times at the Grand Opera House on South State Street.
Yes, which I believe is still standing
to
this day.
Good.
Yes, which you would not know that.
We've got a place to play if we come back then.
Well, that's a possibility.
Okay.
There may be other venues in Marion to
that's
use nowadays
fine.
That would be better. You also played in Bucyrus 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s?
Yes.
You were around this area quite a bit.
We were all over the state, all over the country. And as I said, when we were on tour, unless we were playing somewhere like Cleveland or Chicago, if we played a matinee in Marion, we'd play an evening performance someplace like Lima.
Oh, I see.
So... I see. The circus comes to town and puts on 2 shows. The Sousa band comes to town, puts on 1, and moves on to the next town.
What goes through your head when you sit down to compose one of your musical pieces?
Well, if you give me a pencil and paper, I can write music any time, day or night. It isn't very good music, though, unless I feel inspired, and that's the only way I can describe the process. Writing the Stars and Stripes Forever. In the autumn of 1896, my manager, Mr. Blakely, died. I was in Italy at the time. Mrs. Souza and I got on a steamship and headed for home, and as we crossed the Atlantic, a band was playing in my head, the same melodies over and over and over. When I got to New York on December 25th of 96, I put it down on paper. That was the Stars and Stripes, and still is.
And to this day, we still play that at patriotic events.
Good.
Quite often.
Yeah.
Very popular song.
And
I cannot just sit still when I hear that. I want to march.
Good. It's hitting you where I want it to.
Yes, exactly.
No, the Stars and Stripes, the first season we had it out in 1897, I made a dreadful mistake. I wrote a sung chorus that went with it. It was dreadful. The piece was not a hit in 1898 when the war came with Spain. We put on a traveling pageant, brought the march back without the lyrics, and it's gone from one hit to another.
Oh, so it did originally have lyrics. I did not know that.
It did.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to look that up. Have to Google that later and see.
Okay.
You don't know what Googling is, but it's something we do nowadays to find information.
Well, I know about looking things up.
It's a new way of using an encyclopedia, let's put that.
All right, well.
That you, I know you understand. In your times of touring and so on, did you run across any presidents? Did you get to meet any presidents in person?
Well, when I was an apprentice in the Marine Band, that was during President Johnson and President Grant's presidencies. They weren't exactly buddy-buddy with an apprentice, but I did see them. Now, President Grant was not fond of music. He, they tell me, was tone deaf.
Oh.
Mrs. Grant liked to have music for entertainment, but the president himself, not so much. But when I came back to the Marine Band, we performed for President Hayes, President Garfield, President Cleveland, and President Harrison. He was president when I left the band in 1892.
That would be Benjamin Harrison, I do believe.
Benjamin Harrison, that's correct. And I forgot Chester Arthur, and I shouldn't have, because President Arthur asked me one day how Hail to the Chief had become a presidential tune. I said, well, it's an old drinking song, and it was the title, I suppose, that made them tag it onto the president. He said, could you compose something other than that for events? I did. It's called the Presidential Polonaise for use at indoor presidential events. Unfortunately, President Arthur died before he ever got a chance to hear it. So,
but you did not compose Hail to the Chief. That was before your time.
No, that had been in use since before the Civil War.
Were there any celebrities that you happened to meet along the way that you happened to shake hands with or rub shoulders with?
Well, shortly before the U.S. entered the war in 1917, Charlie Chaplin actually directed part of a concert with the band. I had the best soprano soloists available, Estelle Liebling for one, who toured with the band. I always tried to have a female soprano soloist and a female violinist to lend variety. And one of the requirements, although I never said it to them, was that they look good on stage.
Oh, I see.
So it helped sell the audience.
I think they still use that measurement of entertainment qualities to this day.
I don't think human nature has changed very much in my lifetime.
Not a whole lot. Let's talk about the recording of your songs. At the time that you started writing songs, I do believe that there was such a thing as a phonograph.
Yes.
And
the cylinder phonograph was available. The Marine Band, without me directing, made a few cylinders. I never have cared for recorded music. Mark Twain called it best when he said it's canned music.
Well, that's
There's
true.
There's no substitute for the live article. Mm-hmm. But in the very early days, to make a recording, you'd group whatever musicians you had around a megaphone and start a couple of dozen cylinder phonographs turning, play it into them, take the cylinders off, put a new set on, and play it again.
Oh, okay.
They did not. It took a while for them to come up with duplicating technology to make one master and then many copies. In the Victor catalog now, we have, I think close to 100 selections.
And at this time, I presume that is on the phonograph records, or is that still
shellac disc records?
A shellac disc. Okay.
The cylinder has pretty much passed from.
Sure.
That was Mr. Edison's baby, and the flat disc was simply easier to use.
Now, did some of your music make it to player piano roles?
Oh, I have an idea. I don't play piano well enough to have recorded any, but yes, and.
So in your time, those are two of the big forms of
those
home
are
entertainment.
Two very popular ways of hearing music without having a musician.
And if you can't go to see the musician in person, I suppose that is a good substitute.
It's better than nothing. But there is no substitute for hearing live music played by musicians who know what they're doing.
Once you were married, I don't think you've spoken about this much, but where did you and your wife end up setting up house?
Well, we lived in Washington while I was with the Marine Band. Later on, after the Sousa Band took off, we built a house at Sands Point, Long Island, and lived there. There's room for a stable. I love to ride. Mm-hmm. Room for skeet shooting. Oh. I'm not a great trap shooter, but I love to engage in the sport. That reminds me of a story. The word got out that one weekend I had shot 100 pigeons, and a clergyman wrote me and told me I was an absolutely terrible person to kill that many innocent birds. So after I got the letter, we went out on the range and gathered up the clay pigeons and put them in a box and padded them and sent them to him and said, here's a sample of my pigeons. Now, you'll need to boil them a long time for them to be really edible.
You know what? I never even thought about them being clay pigeons. I was thinking actual birds, too. So, Okay. That's a pretty good story there. How do you like to be called Mr., or do you prefer your given title in the Marines?
Well, I haven't been a Marine for some time, and I was only an enlisted man there. My wife calls me Philip, as my parents did. The fellas in the band, although they don't think I've noticed, refer to me as Governor.
Okay.
But as long as you address me with reasonable civility, I'll take almost anything.
Well, that's good. Do you have any stories from the time you were on the road and time you were touring that you'd like to share with us?
Well, a few years ago, I found myself talking to a circus bandmaster, never having made it to the circus myself, and I said, well, you play a concert before and after the show, don't you? And he said, yes, that's our custom. I said, I imagine you play some of my music. And he said, well, yes, we do. And I said, I expect you play the Stars and Stripes Forever. And he said, no, we never play that, which took me a little aback. When somebody tells me my most successful piece is something they never perform, I said, why not? He said, in the circus, the Stars and Stripes Forever is a disaster march. If something goes wrong, if the tent collapses, if a fire breaks out, if an aerialist falls, if an animal gets out of a cage, the band strikes up the Stars and Stripes for two reasons. One, it's familiar to everyone in the audience and comforts them. And two, hearing that, every circus employee on the grounds knows to come running, because that's never part of the program. With a circus, if you've worked there a while, if you can hear what the band is playing, you know exactly what act is on. But in any event, I got to thinking about the Stars and Stripes as a disaster march, and I've used it that way too.
You did?
I have. One time in Texas, we were playing in an auction barn, seated 3,000 people, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That year, we had a composition by Richard Strauss, if you like, called Death and Transfiguration. Beautiful piece of music, about 20 minutes long. I called it up onto the stands, and the first chair clarinetist looked at me and kind of cocked an eyebrow and looked out at the crowd who were out there in their 10-gallon hats and Western finery, and I knew what he was telling me. We had arranged Death and Transfiguration so it could be compressed from 20 minutes into 8 without losing anything substantial.
Mm-hmm.
So I turned to the boys and said, make the cuts. Now, I've been standing with my back to audiences for 40 years. And you don't develop ears in the back of your head, but you develop quite a sensitivity to what's going on behind you. If things are going well, the audience silence.
Mm-hmm.
If things aren't going well, you hear feet start to shuffle and programs start to rustle and people start to cough. That was starting as we played Death and Transfiguration. So I got through to the end of it all right and turned to the band and said, "Stars, we got them back." Now, we played Stars and Stripes at almost every concert, and sometimes two or three times if we needed it. So I didn't realize it, but Stars and Stripes Forever is my disaster march. If things aren't going well, I know how to bring them back.
It was a very popular and very very stirring piece.
It's
for sure.
A very popular and, as you say, very stirring piece of music. If you don't want to get up and march, then you never will. But
better see if your heart's still beating if you don't get up to that one, yeah.
If it's something interesting about our programs, if you came to a Sousa concert, if you come to a Sousa concert, you'll find 9 numbers on the program.
Okay.
And that's the same 9 numbers whether we're playing in New York or Kalamazoo or Ada, Ohio, or an auction barn in Texas. But that's only the part of the schedule you see. Now, we generally play at least one encore between every piece on the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
One evening, we had an audience that was really responsive, and one of the boys totted up that we had played the 9 originals plus 27 encores.
Oh, my.
So if we got a cold house, well, you'll get the 9 pieces and probably 9 encores. If the audience gives us some of its energy, we'll give it everything we've got.
Back to your on-the-road stories. Mm-hmm. Do you have any others you'd like to share that you can think of? You've had quite a career, and I'm sure there are other interesting stories from your...
Well, one time when we were touring in England, it was a small town and a small theater. In that town, the town carpenter was also the town undertaker, and he built an extension on the stage so we could get the whole band on there.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't build it very well.
Oh, my. I'm picturing this already before you tell the story.
with the new march that in any given season, I always bring the trumpets and trombones down front to finish it, to do the finale. And I always do it with the Stars and Stripes or whatever. In any case, that evening, I forget what march we were playing. I called them down front. They came down front, and the stage collapsed. I have a large cast iron music stand that I use to hold my music, and I fell 7 feet into the orchestra pit, but thank God one of the fellows in the band caught that music stand, or I'd have been a dead man.
Oh, my. So yeah.
Things don't always go as you expect.
So maybe the undertaker was looking for some extra work? I don't know.
I don't know. I know I never played that town again.
Yeah, you were a hit.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, literally.
And almost got hit, but...
What are some other songs at your, you know, at the time of your popularity, what are some other big songs that are popular?
Well,
or some other composers.
Well, Victor Herbert was working from the 1890s up till 1925, and Mr. Herbert had an absolute gift for melody. He wrote a lot of light opera, verging toward musical comedy. So did I. At one time, around 1900, I had 3 musicals on Broadway at the same time.
Oh, I didn't know that you had musicals. That's...
I wrote 17 of them.
Oh, my. Didn't know that.
The Charlatan, El Capitan, and The Bride Elect. So yes, there's a lot of music around, and if an audience decided they wanted to hear a kind of music, we'd play it. If an audience decided they would like to hear Turkey in the Straw, fine, we'll do it as an encore. But we will do it in the best possible arrangement and the best possible manner. So you will hear it better done than you've ever heard it before. One of the things that I stress with the band, and it makes it difficult for new members who join, is that I want all the musicians in a section to sound exactly the same. I remember in 1893, before our first major season, I spent 3 hours with the first clarinetist on a piece, going over and over and over it till he got it just the way I wanted. Then I turned to the second clarinet and said, okay, I want you to do just as he's doing. Mm-hmm. That has a couple of benefits from a performance standpoint. First, it gives the band a very smooth sound. You don't have individual players sticking out in different places. The other thing is that it gives you an enormous dynamic range. If I've got four cornets and I can go from one of them playing pianissimo to four of them playing fortissimo flat out, I have a range that no symphony orchestra or any other organization can match. For dynamics, there is nothing better or more supple than a band. As a matter of fact, 1 year in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Orchestra challenged us to a contest with the local newspaper or music critics to be the judges as to who was the better group of musicians. We won. We were better than they were. But, on the other hand, we were playing our programs twice a day, 6 months at a stretch. And if you don't get good at it over that length of time, you're just not paying attention.
Well, we were talking about, I had asked you about other artists of your time. Did you ever have any encounters with Daniel Emmett? He was actually from right here in Ohio.
I think Mr. Emmett died before I organized my band. Daniel Decatur Emmett, the fellow who wrote Dixie.
He died in 1904.
No, I can't say as I ever met him. No,
I just wondered.
But we did get the benefit of his music. In 1895, we were offered a job playing at the Cotton States Exposition. We got to Atlanta where it was being put on, and the promoters said, we can't afford to pay you. We're not drawing flies to this event. And I said, you give me a place to set up and play. We'll fix that. I had my announcer get up and tell the audience that for our first piece, well, we had a new march that year, King Cotton, and the encore would be Dixie. And the next piece would be My Country 'Tis of Thee, and the encore would be Dixie.
Okay.
Every encore was Dixie. And we literally dragged that event out of the red and into the black because we gave the audience what they wanted to hear. If they want us to play Dixie, I'll play Dixie.
You ain't just whistling Dixie, are you?
No. But that reminds me, during the war, I joined the Navy. I tried to get into the Army, but they said, sir, you're 62 years old. You're too old. The Navy said, you're 62 years old. What commission would you like? I toured the country. I think I even came to Marion with a 320-piece band.
320-piece?
320 pieces. Not a man of them over 25 years old. Directed by a man who was 62 years old. In the course of those tours, one of the boys figured up that we marched over 400 miles. But getting back to Dixie, one of the places we played in the autumn of 1917 was Baltimore. Mm-hmm. They had a 3-day war bond rally there. Now, they had arranged pledges up to I think, $6 million so that the event wouldn't be a bust. We came and played. Some of the bright young fellas in my band got the idea of standing up and saying, if someone will pledge $100,000, we'll play Dixie. And a few minutes later, we'd get the word that we had the pledge.
Oh, my.
And we'd play it. All right, if someone will pledge $250,000, we'll play Maryland, My Maryland. Same thing happened. The young fellas, well, some of my sailors were better marketers than I. Between pieces, they would take the baton out of my hand and hold it up and say, who wants to own a baton used by John Philip Sousa? And somebody would say, well, I'll give you $50 for it. And they'd stare him down and say, this is a fundraiser. This is not a charity event. They were selling 20-cent batons for $250 a piece.
Oh, my.
But by the time that three-day event in Baltimore was over, we and the others who participated in it had raised $20 million in war bonds for the war effort.
Oh, that's great.
That's a number I still have trouble grasping.
But there was a lot of patriotism.
There was a lot of patriotism, and apparently we were hitting the right notes with the audience.
Yes, literally. Yes, very much so.
So, yeah, as I said, I spent 12 years directing the Marine Band, 2 years directing a Navy band, and almost 40 years directing my band, the Sousa Band.
So there was a Sousa Band?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we call it.
Okay. I just was familiar with you being with the Marines and with...
No.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
I made my living, and so did a lot of musicians, for almost 40 years as the Sousa Band. And I always have figured, it hasn't come up, but when I'm no longer able to direct, my guess is the band will go away. People come to see me, and I'm not boasting, as much as they come to hear the band.
That's probably true, Mr. Sousa.
And I know there have been occasions when a couple of occasions when I started concerts and was ill enough that I had to be carried off on a stretcher during the concert. But I turned up and I did the best I could.
Very much a crowd pleaser. There's something we haven't discussed yet.
What's that?
And that is that instrument that you developed or helped develop with your name, the Bears Your Name.
Pepper in Philadelphia came up with the original idea. When I first began as a musician, bass horns were kind of carried in front of you with a horn that faced forward. Mm-hmm. I did not find it a satisfactory sound. Mr. Pepper in Philadelphia developed a bass horn that wrapped around the musician and had a bell that projected the sound upward. So we were projecting a cloud of bass notes over the entire band. I'd like to say I invented it. I didn't. I think my name has been used to successfully market it. The Kahn Instrument Company in Indiana makes most of the instruments for my band, and they've made quite a good thing out of making bass horn sousaphones.
With using your name, did you get any royalties or any kind of...
Whenever I could.
Okay.
After selling marches for $35 a shot outright, no. If I can get a royalty for endorsing a horn, a cigar, well, as a matter of fact, the Ithaca Gun Company has a Sousa-grade trap shotgun. Now, they do give me a little something for that, including nice shotguns, but no. I'm perfectly willing to capitalize on my
So
my
they
name.
Just used your name. You really had nothing to do with the development of that instrument?
No.
Okay.
Other than to say, that's a good idea.
That's
and
wonderful.
When they said, well, do we turn the bell forward? I said, no, turn it up. And I understand school bands now are using them with the bell turned forward. That is as it is. But school bands mostly play outside, and my band plays indoors. We've only marched, I think, 6 times in all the years I've had it. Twice in 1898, seeing troops off to the Spanish-American War. Once in 1899, welcoming Admiral Dewey back. Mm-hmm. And twice in 1915 and 16. Those 2 seasons, we worked at the New York Hippodrome in New York. We would give a concert before the program, and we were the pit band for the acts. The Hippodrome's quite a place. It's got a stage 100 feet deep and 200 feet wide.
Oh, my.
Biggest stage I've ever seen or been on. Mm-hmm. They could bring railroad trains onto it, horses, elephants. Now, some of the boys liked playing there because that meant for 2 seasons we didn't travel all over the country. Some of them got very bored because we didn't travel all over the country. But, we've played in a lot of venues in a lot of circumstances. In the 1927 season, we did a motion picture tour where we would go play a concert. They'd play a flicker. We'd play some more and maybe accompany part of the movie. Mm-hmm. So... We've okay. tried, the Sousa Band and I have tried many, many things.
Now, do you incorporate your violin playing into that band, or have you put that aside? Is that something you still enjoy doing?
No, it's something I do on my own. But as I said, we always have a female violin soloist with the band. And I never noticed, but recently someone pointed out to me that some of the marches that I've written that are very difficult for brass players are very simple if you're playing the violin. So that tells me that my mind is still where it was as a boy.
This is just an off-the-cuff question, but does your wife play any instruments? Or
no.
Has she?
No. Mrs. Sousa sings.
She sings. Okay.
And since I've managed to get a little bit of success, she's perfectly willing to be a listener.
Okay.
Although I don't think she's a very good judge of music. I remember one rehearsal she came in. We had played something I had written, ended it. I turned to the band and said, I can't imagine who wrote that trash. And Mrs. Sousa at the back of the auditorium said, oh, Philip, that was marvelous. So I turned back to the boys and said, well, there you have it. It's marvelous.
Can't get a better endorsement than that, can you?
No. If you keep Mama happy, life goes better.
So where are you currently living? Are you...
Sands Point, Long
you're,
Island.
You're still there?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I was injured a couple of years ago riding... I'm very fond of riding horses,
yes,
very fond
that.
Of Arabians. I was riding a horse named Patrolman Charlie, who suddenly developed the blind staggers and threw me. Now, I am not at the age anymore where being thrown by a horse is a minor thing. It cracked a couple of bones in my neck, and the doctor said, well, you may never... walk again, much less conduct a band. 10 weeks later, we were back on the road. All it did was change my conducting style. In the early years, I conducted very wide and sweeping. Since the broken neck, I tend to conduct from the waist.
I see.
Because
yes.
The arms won't go up where they once did. But we're still making music.
Well, that's a good thing. We got a little bit less than a minute. Anything else you want to add today, Mr. Sousa?
Encourage live music in your community. Encourage school bands. Encourage singing groups. America is a musical nation. There are a lot of us, and there's a lot of talent out there. But only if people get a chance to exercise it. That's what bothers me about recorded music. You're not making music, you're just absorbing sounds. Mm-hmm. And that's not good for the music or for the listener.
Well, you've been listening to John Philip Sousa, my guest here on WWGH's Mike Wilson Show. And thank you for being with us today.